Welcome. This is Mark Steiner, and we welcome you to our program this evening. On a way to a conversation, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the University of Maryland Transplant Program. Nearly 2,000 Marylanders are awaiting for an organ transplant. The University of Maryland conducts research and performs procedures designed to optimize transplant rates and provide least invasive surgeries for organ donors. More information about the University of Maryland's transplant program and becoming an organ donor is available online at umm.edu/transplant. And we are joined here in studio by Karen Weber-Nador, who is Baltimore City School's Executive Director for Student Support and Safety. Good to have you in the studio.
Welcome.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you for coming. David Miller is Chief Visionary Officer and co-founder of the Urban Leadership Institute and a former Baltimore educator, still educating in different ways, in the studio with us. He was on this morning on Baltimore Brew with us as well, talking about mentoring. Ajaz Baluk is with us, and Ajaz is a social studies teacher at the Connection School for the Arts, Teacher for America Corps member. Iris Kirsch is with us, Baltimore City school teacher, worker owner of Red Emma's Bookstore and Coffee House, and writes a biweekly column on education for the Baltimore Indie Reader called Future Imperfect, an education report for the Tense Times, available at indiereader.org/future. There's a lot to say about you, Iris. And the number here is 410-319-8888. Now, this show started because of the articles we were reading in The Sun about the suspension policies in the Baltimore City Schools in this experimental program that actually has been operating in two major schools, where they're successful in two major schools, Calverton and Commodore John Rogers Elementary Middle Schools. And the program itself is trying to decrease the number of young people who are thrown out of school, who are suspended from school, in these what they call turnaround schools. And in that program, they have had kids whose families who are for nonviolent offenses, cutting class, inciting, participating in public disturbances, classroom disruption, insubordination, disrespect. Instead of being suspended, they were moved into other programs to get teachers to be more active in the kids' lives. There was some Saturday school detention. And those two schools out of the other schools actually made the quota and reduced their suspensions. Other schools didn't, and bonuses were paid to every staff member at the schools where those took place. So it was interesting. I mean, people have been trying to wrestle with this. I know that Andres Alonso has been wrestling with this issue of suspension, started that new school at North Avenue for young people who were thrown out to keep them in schools. He put them there so they wouldn't be on the street. And there's a lot of controversy over suspension, which we've been covering here for 20 years. When we first started this program out, one of the first stories we did was at Lombard Middle School back then, which had a federal grant where no student was suspended from the school at all for anything. Those school students were put into a special in-school suspension program where they had counselors and had their schoolwork done there. They went through group counseling, individual counseling, and more. Federal grant ran out, and so did the program. Mm-hmm. So we're still wrestling with this issue today, and welcome all of you to the studio. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Twitter us at tweet us, I should say. Did I say Twitter us? I meant tweet us. Thank you. Get my generation stuff right. At Mark Steiner. Write to us on our Facebook pages as well. So let me start, Karen Weber-Nador, with you and talk about this policy and where it came from and what it's supposed to be doing.
Okay. First of all, I just want to clarify that it's not really a policy. A policy is something that's ongoing, long-lasting. This was a one-shot deal for a two-year period, and it was started by MSDE, Maryland State Department of Education. It wasn't something that we instituted as a long-term fix. What we are doing for a long-term fix is really focusing on school climate. Anyone who's ever been a teacher or a principal knows that you cannot teach in chaos. Recently, I was appointed to this position after serving as the principal of the National Academy Foundation High School as the principal. And I was appointed to this position primarily because climate was my thing. Climate was what I started off with to bring about academic success and overall well-being for the students and the faculty. So I've brought that philosophy with me into the district. And we have begun a very intensive deep dive into looking at school climate. We started with 32 schools, and we first of all, one of the things we had to do is the messaging. What does the code of conduct say as it exists? Our code of conduct is one of the most progressive in the nation. The state currently is mimicking their code of conduct after hours. But are we applying it? So some of the messaging just had to be about re-educating.
So let me come back to the question of progressive and what that means. I'm going to talk about that. We'll come back to that in a minute. But I'm curious as to the teacher's reaction. And Ajaz, let me start with you since you're active in the classroom now.
I think that on the one hand, it is important to try and keep students in school as much as possible, especially students who are having difficulty because those are the ones who are most at risk. However, I think that when you create incentives to lower suspension rates, so a lot of times what principals and administrations end up doing is they bring that number down artificially. And the way they do that is even if a student were to commit, a violent offense, if there's a fight that breaks out in a classroom, normally that would automatically, no questions asked, be a suspension. And what principals, end up doing sometimes, and they're not allowed to do this necessarily, but they don't suspend the students. And that can send the wrong message to the rest of the student body and to the other teachers.
So, Iris, and you're not actively teaching at the moment. You will be again.
Right, yeah.
We got a mic swelling up here? Thanks.
Sorry, I was sitting back a little. Well, I really agree a lot with what Ijaz just said. I feel like, first of all, paying bonuses is a bad system. It's assuming that teachers aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing already, and incentivizing luck in a lot of ways. So, for example, one of the things that teachers at these schools started to do was more home visits. Well, that's great. Teachers are supposed to get paid $30 an hour for anything we do outside of school. Why not, instead of saying you get a bonus if your home visits are, successful in the way we want them to be, then you get this bonus. Why not just say we have money to pay some teachers to do home visits and we'd really like teachers to do more home visits? I think that home visits can be incredibly effective. The other side of it is whether suspensions are the only way to hold students accountable. We really do desperately need to hold our children accountable. I talk all the time to former students who've been let go from jobs, who are in trouble with the law, who are out of relationships that they really cared about, because they expect to get a lot more chances than many of us expect to get because they got all these chances in school. But there are lots of ways to hold people accountable other than saying, go away. You can't do this here, so therefore go away. So I'd like to see more put into in-school suspension and that kind of other programs that hold students really to a high level of accountability.
And from an educator who observes from the outside, at least in terms of our schools, though you are in schools.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that this is a very intriguing conversation. I think that I just want to start off by just saying that it's important that we uplift teachers because, teachers – and all of us in the room have taught it in some capacity at some time, is an awesome calling. Now, we do know some of the teachers shouldn't have necessarily answered the phone, but that's a whole other discussion. I think that the challenge that I have is, as this young lady indicated, is that when we have systems in place, whether it's a matter of written policy or unwritten policy, where we're just not going to suspend people because we don't want our school to come up on somebody's radar screen with a whole lot of suspensions, what that does is it does the young people a disservice.
Exactly.
And there are schools right now, like if all of us got in the car tomorrow morning and went to some of the schools in the city, we would be absolutely appalled by the lack of engagement, the fact that you have students who are literally doing whatever they want to do, and many times our colleagues who are teachers are being held hostage because if they keep complaining about X number of students, their job might be in jeopardy. And I think that if we are really seriously going to grow our city, greater efforts need to be placed on family accountability. I just don't think that parent participation is really part of the equation. I think we talk about it a lot. I think we set up advisory boards and task forces to look at parent participation, but my experience having 25 or so years in the game doing this work at a number of different levels, I've never met a parent that didn't want the best for their child. Mm-hmm. But I have met a lot of parents who do not necessarily know how to navigate school culture and who are having some of the same kinds of challenges with their children at home that the teachers are having. And so a lot of times the parents are absolutely overwhelmed, and I would just rather see greater emphasis placed on how do we make this parent community school bridge. But to say that we're not going to suspend students, I mean, Mark, we could get in a car tomorrow and I could take y'all to some Baltimore City schools and you would be in tears at the level of behavior by students and the lack of engagement by teachers. And oftentimes it's just a matter of teachers are overwhelmed and do not necessarily feel like they're getting the support from North Avenue.
So first, before I jump in here and throw out some questions that have come out from what all four of you have said, I want to encourage our listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888. We would like to really hear from you, teachers, parents, students. You don't have to be in the city. Wherever you live, in the county schools, your idea about suspensions, about how to deal with disorderly students, your own experience of being a disorderly student, or teacher trying to deal with a disorderly student. Since I've been both, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com and give us your thoughts and ideas. We really do want to hear them. So how do you deal with it? I mean, all right, A, you know that if you're in a classroom, if anybody's ever been a teacher, and we've had two people, all five of us have been teachers in this room, right? Some of us in this room have actually had to manage a school. I have. So the question is, how do you deal with that? A disruptive student, or two or one or two disruptive students in a class of 30 kids can destroy an entire classroom. You have to focus on that student. And we expect teachers, I think, sometimes to be the one to deal with all of it when you have all these students. You can't. So the question is, how do you address that? People are always fighting over how you kind of deal with that issue. And I'm just curious how we think we should deal with it. And I'll let you go first, Karen.
Thank you. first of all, I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah.
In my opinion, there was a time when Baltimore City Schools, you could go into one after the other and be just in hysterics about what you saw. I don't find that to be the case anymore, and I can back that up just by saying we are actively doing climate walks. It's a new tool that we've developed to actually assess what's going on in terms of the school climate in our schools, and it has been very successful. I also want to negate the idea that we have a policy that says no suspensions. What we don't want is knee-jerk suspensions. You did X, therefore you get suspended. Nobody's talking to the child. The student voice is absolutely absent. The teacher voice is absent. Someone is alleged to have done something, and then this is the punishment. And then we have this language that is so prevalent, it's sending a message. I don't know what message is sending because the suspensions keep mounting under that type of circumstance. What we have to do is engage our students and find out what's going on. Have the conversation. There are all types of alternatives to suspension, and I'm going to use that word progressive again, that are progressive in that they involve the student and make them accountable right on the spot. community conferencing is longstanding.
Yeah.
There are all types of in mediation. Sometimes it's peer mediation, student court, you name it. Time has to be invested. Money has to be invested up front, but the payoff is phenomenal. It's not only a learning opportunity, but your climate will change, and people have to put the time in. It's an adult problem. It's not a student problem because the students come as they are. What are the adults going to do about it? Because it's going to happen year after year if it's not addressed.
So I hear what you're saying, Karen. So the question is, what does that mean on the ground for
relationships? And what I mean by that is, one of the things I thought when I came into the classroom is that I had come there to impart my wisdom. The kids could care less about my wisdom. What they cared about is who was I and why was I there? And until I made a bridge and made relationships with those students, they could care less about what I said. And some people don't even know that that's what they're being asked to do when they come into the classroom.
But let me just throw this out, and please just jump in here because I want to get to these people calling in. I mean, because even the most dynamic teacher, when you have five classes a day of 30 kids apiece, it's difficult to build a personal relationship with 150 students. It's not that easy. I mean, you can you can create an atmosphere where students want to be there and they enjoy your class and they love learning and they can participate, at least most of them will. But you can't build a relationship with every individual student you have in the course of a day.
So even when you have good relationships with students, sometimes they're dealing with so much nonsense outside of school, outside of the classroom, in the teacher's before you class, that they still come to you with all kinds of other things going on. The school, Heritage High School, had what was called an accountability center. And a really amazing woman ran it. She trained herself to do discipline. She worked with street soldiers and some other groups around the world and learned how to reach out to students so that when I had a young woman who, it was her junior year, she'd been a big behavior issue, whatever that means, for her first 2 years of school, and then she was really trying to get her act together, which brilliant, brilliant young lady. And we really developed a good rapport. And then during her midterm exam, she must have had an altercation with somebody else outside of my room, came in and would not listen to me, threw my book across the classroom and cussed me out. In 6 years of teaching, I had never been cussed out by a student. And so I said, you got to get out of here and you can't come back until I have a conference with your mom. And mom works all the time. So it was a couple days. She could go to the accountability center. She could sit with that woman, do her work, get some degree of counseling, and have a safe place to be. Whereas the other children in my class could see, you can't cuss out Kirsch. You can't just do that and you're going to come right back. Mm-hmm. There's going to be real consequences, but we didn't just throw her out into the wild.
But the adults set that system up.
Right, yes.
And that's what I meant earlier about sending a message, is that that action signaled to the other students that kind of behavior is unacceptable and does not meet the expectations set by the teacher and set by the school. And I think the danger is when, how do you at the same time keep as many students as you can in school while at the same time not compromising your expectations and lowering them because you are trying to keep more students in school and suspending less students? And finding that balance, I think, is really the key to making this effective.
David, tell me then we're going to open the
question. These are not easy challenges to solve. And I know a lot of times we make it seem like we can just do A and it'll solve B.
Right.
But I do think, and I know there's efforts in Baltimore City, smaller learning communities is critically important. I think when I was teaching at Calverton Middle School several years ago, I mean, I had 37 students in the class. I mean, you know, I would love to see a system where we had no more than 15 students in a class in an optimal situation, because it's a lot easier to manage 15 students. You know, 12 of those students may have had rough backgrounds, family management issues, you know, the whole gamut. It's a little easier to manage 15 students. Here's the other thing that I think that we have to confront. I think everybody in the room would agree that Baltimore City Public Schools has made some amazing strides.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
definitely
one of the challenges is, I'm just amazed that Baltimore City just doesn't tout what it does enough. So I would recommend that the city school system needs to hire a PR firm, because there's a lot of good stuff that's being done, but you never hear about it. And so what ends up happening is you read the article in the Sun paper about X number of children doing whatever, X number of teachers doing whatever, but you don't read about the amazing students and teachers that are, you know, dealing with insurmountable odds and their positive outcomes. And so that's the first thing, horrible PR on the part of Baltimore City Public Schools. The second thing is that I think that we got to find a way in urban school districts to cast a larger net as it comes to, with respect to recruitment. Because a lot of the folks that we're recruiting to be teachers are really nice people, but they can't cut it. And I'm being real nice. I mean, they're really, really nice people. They go to some really great academic universities. But you take somebody who went to a really lovely school in Maine, and then you bring them to Baltimore, and then you provide them with, you know,
no support.
Training. 6 weeks of training. You get in 2 to 3 days before school starts. They tell you to transform this classroom.
Right.
you know, and get in there with your grade book and make it happen. And so from a training and a recruitment and a development standpoint, I think that there's a lot of work that we can do. Last point. There's a program called Call Me Mister that I'm sure mm-hmm. some of you are familiar with at Clemson University mm-hmm. in South Carolina. And I'm just amazed that in cities like Baltimore, where we have a Morgan State, right, mm-hmm. you got a Compton, you got a Sojourner Douglas, that we haven't created a Call Me Mister pipeline to recruit African-American male teachers. There are young men who would like to teach, but nobody approaches them. And so as we always talk about the cradle-to-prison pipeline, mm-hmm. one of the ways that we can disrupt the pipeline is we got to make sure that we get more men in the building. Mm-hmm. Got to do it. And I just don't see efforts. Baltimore City Public Schools recruits teachers in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. I'm just blown away by the number of teachers that I've trained from the Philippines who come from sort of a different cultural landscape, and you drop them off on Edmondson Avenue. That's like a culture shock. You come from the Philippines to then teach in a school. And so I just think that there's so many things that we can do in terms of moving to the next level, but recruitment of teachers, smaller classrooms, and I would just love to see how we could pay teachers to work over the summer, not just a handful of teachers, but to have more teachers work over the summer to work on their craft. I mean, those are things that are critically important if we really want to reduce suspensions.
So before we jump back in, Karen, I know you have, I can see you getting ready to leap in here and have something to say about this. I want to hear you. But let me go to the phones and get some listeners in here.
Okay.
Come back to what we've just raised at 410-319-8888. The topic is suspensions and how to deal with unruly kids and children in our schools, how we respond as a school, how you respond as a parent, how we respond as a system, and how we respond as a young person to it. Mm-hmm. And Aaron on the east side, you're on the air.
Well, how are you all today, first of all?
Very well. Welcome.
Well, I think the big problem with our school system, to be honest, is, well, three things. One, we need to get rid of Dr. Alonzo. That's the first thing. The second thing, where I'm sitting in the General Assembly, I would not give the city of Baltimore another dime until he was fired. And in addition to that, we need to go back to some of the models we had in the years before we created this middle school model. I think if we go back to having junior elementary school from pre-K to sixth grade, junior high from seventh to ninth grade, and high school from 10th to 12th grade, I think we did better with that model than we do today.
And what was the third one?
I'm sorry, what?
I thought you had three things.
Yeah, going back to the junior high model.
Okay, gotcha.
And eliminating, getting rid of Dr. Alonzo, and developing better recruitment opportunities for teachers. In addition to that, we gotta have this concept of maybe having our teachers live in the communities they serve.
All right, well, let's wrestle with something. I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to wrestle with Dr. Alonzo's appointment at the moment. I mean, he's been on the show many times, and I think that. I mean, I have some issues with some things that Andres Alonzo has put in the school system, but he's also done some incredible things in terms of changing the culture of schools and recruiting new teachers and the like as well. So, I mean, and he's committed himself to the city. He said he was going to stay for 10 years. He seems to be on the road to doing that.
Absolutely.
But what about some of the other things? I mean, I think part of how we organize schools is part of the issue, mm-hmm. which are things you were raising. I think that our schools are, in some places, still organized like these behemoths.
Well, let me ask you a question. I'm interested for the young lady to respond. If we know that much of the data talks about smaller learning communities, smaller classrooms, would it be too much of a pipe dream to want to have schools where we have 10 to 15 students? Is that?
Well,
it comes down to budgets. And
I was going to say one of the issues is that the monies have been pushed to the schools, and the principals have a great deal of autonomy in determining how they're going to spend those monies. Mm-hmm. So the schools where they see that as the primary necessity have more teachers than anything else. I know when I was a principal, the first thing I did was slate as many teachers as I could possibly get for the money. Everybody has a different rationale as to how they're going to approach their schools. And at this point, We're talking about bounded autonomy. That's how we're being organized.
Let me ask a question about that. I mean, do we think? I can't ask a question. Bobby Malvermoz, my producer, is saying he's breaking his hands, but it seems we have to take a break. But when we come back from that break, Keith, you're the next caller up, and Katie, who's a teacher, we're going to go to you. We'll get your call in as well. But I want to talk about whether or not this that system is a workable system. And we'll come back to that conversation. Don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We'll continue our conversation here. I'm going to remind you on the way to that conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com or go to steinershow.org. Click on their banner. It's there always. They have been supporting the show since we've been here at WEAA, and we support them. Number here is 410-319-8888. We're going to come to Keith in just a second. We are here in the studio today with Karen Weber-Nador, who is the Baltimore City Public Schools Executive Director of Student Support and Safety, Iris Kirsch, Baltimore City teacher, worker-owner at Red M's Bookstore, writes a weekly column on education for the Baltimore Indie Reader called Future Imperfect, and Ajaz Baluk, who is a socialist teacher at Connections School for the Arts and a Teach for America core member, David Miller, chief visionary officer and co-founder of the Urban Leadership Institute and former Baltimore educator. Now, Keith, we're going to get right to your call, but as we do that, let me just pick up where we left off, because you continued the conversation during the break. And part of how we continue the conversation is what kind of policies do you set? And you were asking some provocative questions, David. You were saying, is it crazy to think we can have a school system with 15 teachers per classroom? Is it crazy to think that...
15 students.
15 students.
Right.
Maybe we need 15 teachers. I don't know. 15 students. We were up early this morning. So 15.
Right.
And you were raising some issues about some other schools that you had seen, like the Eagle.
I mean, I also think it's vision. I think it's will. You know, but I think that these are some of the kinds of questions. And then we talk a lot about data and research, but how often does the research guide our practice? Mm-hmm. If we see examples of best practices all over the country where smaller learning communities, smaller number of students in a classroom, because, again, it's real hard to connect with 30 students, one teacher.
And Iris was challenging the idea that all teachers have to be from Baltimore City, that you can have a kind of multicultural staff as long as people are acclimated to the system, to the community, and can create teaching in our schools. And that came up during our break as well.
Right, but that we really need to work on trying to retain teachers and recruit people who actually want to be in Baltimore City, mm-hmm. not people who want to use it as a stepping stone to their master's degree, you know, careers.
And we have another for a minute. Ajaz, why don't you jump in here, then we'll open the phones.
I just wanted to jump in because at my school at Connections, every single one of my classes has between 15 and 20 students. Mm-hmm. So it is very possible, and I can tell you it right. makes a tremendous difference, because earlier we talked about building relationships, and I know each one of my 64 students extremely well. And at the end of the day, because I only have 64 yeah. students, I can call each one of the mothers of the students who I thought was not meeting my behavioral expectations for that day, and it's not a tremendous burden, and it's something I can execute very effectively because my class sizes are that small.
Mm-hmm. That's important. And your school is an arts-based school. Mm-hmm. It's in the Oldham Middle School.
Yep.
On the northwest side of town. And I think that's those are examples of how schools can change, but they have to be invested in to do that. And I think maybe part of the problem we were talking about before we left, and I think that can be challenged, and I've challenged Dr. Alonzo on this before, is this whole model of having the principals kind of manage this budget. Mm. And there's so many inconsistencies in that. There's certain things, it seems to me, the principals can manage, which is their school. Mm-hmm. And schools get money for their teachers and they get money for their roofs. And why should a principal manage that?
Well, the thing is, if you have the skill set, you can do some amazing things by having control over your budget. Principals who are visionary can really roll out and implement some amazing processes. I think one of the challenges we're having as a country, as a nation, is getting and retaining quality leadership and principles. And we're seeing that especially in urban centers, but we're seeing that all over the nation. And it's because it is such a demanding job.
Well, I think that we can think about, and I'll just go to the phones here, but there's the toss out here shows we're going to be producing in the future just about ideas around other school systems. And you might look at a place like Finland, yes. It's mm-hmm. a homogeneous nation, yes. It's a wealthy nation. All that's true. Mm-hmm. That what notwithstanding, they pay teachers a lot of money. The number one job people want in Finland is to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. It'll be equivalent to paying a teacher $100,000 to $125,000 a year and they're respected.
But they almost never fire teachers either. They work with teachers to get them past whatever problems they're having in the classroom.
And they have small classrooms and they invest a lot of money in their school system.
Mm-hmm.
And
they also have far fewer standardized tests than we have. Well, and they also believe in creative play as part of their educational philosophy.
One of the people we're going to be interviewing very soon is the superintendent, Dr. Schwartz, of the Montgomery County Public Schools, who says we should suspend all testing for the next 3 years.
Amen. Bingo.
At least 3 years.
As I said to Governor Martin O'Malley in an Annapolis session, he was a little taken aback by the question, but I said to him, you went to Catholic school, didn't you?
Mm.
He said, yeah, and now you're governor of the state of Maryland. And you didn't have one bevy of sanitized tests, did you, at your school when you went to Catholic school? Mm-hmm. Your teachers taught you, you were graded on them, and you were off to succeed. Wow. What's wrong with that system?
Right.
That's right.
It's good enough for you. Why isn't it good enough for our kids?
Right. That's right.
So, anyway, I'll get off my soapbox here. Go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Keith, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, welcome.
Thanks for taking my call. My first experience was, I want to share this experience, because I tested the waters, and I went into substitute teaching. It was also a way for me to really determine whether or not teaching is my forte, and that's the way I want to go. And I recommend for a lot of people that, you know, they take that route. Maybe you might want to go in as a substitute teacher to get a feel of what that environment is like, and to, you know, to see, you know, if this is a profession that's really for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just with any other profession. It may not be, you know, the profession that you need to be in. It may take someone else, who would be a perfect fit for this. And we need to accept that. Mm-hmm. There's some jobs that I can do and some jobs like, no. I agree with all of the statements that your guests made, from even the perspective of what I found out as a substitute teacher was that my first experience was I learned that I experienced karma. A lot of the things that the students acted out, I did that too. So it was like, in a way, it was like a mirror. I'm looking at myself in this mirror.
Okay, so what did you learn from that?
What did I learn from it?
Yeah.
Well, being, you know, now the adult, I saw that, you know, this is somewhat a developmental stage that, you know, you have to kind of like be aware of. I learned a lot about black males, and I'm glad the guy brought up the subject about needing more black male teachers. As a black male growing up in the inner cities of Baltimore also, and then moving into that role as the teacher, I learned that I saw a lot of anger. A lot of anger that black males, young black male students seem to have towards adult black males. I thought that was a very interesting observation that I experienced.
Okay, so
I don't think that every black male would make a good teacher. So to say that we need more black males in the school system, yeah, but it may not be that particular black male.
Okay, so let me let a response come up, because we have a lot of people calling in. I want to get a chance to get to other callers here, and we lost one of our teachers calling in. I'm going to go to Ben, the next teacher calling in. But all right, let's go to the Ben in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say, three quick things. The first is, I know it's popular to disparage Dr. Alonzo, and to be totally direct, I think he's a good guy, and he's trying the best he can. And frankly, I think that he's done some good. I don't agree with him on everything, and in fact, I'm about to disagree with him vocally. But as a teacher, I think he's trying his best, and I think he's done some very good things. The second thing I wanted to say is on suspension. I can tell you what doesn't work, and that is, ignoring the problem makes it a lot worse. Now, I don't think suspensions are particularly effective. They make the problem worse. They tend to get home. I don't think that that is a long-term solution. But I also think that if you ignore the problem and you don't have some kind of meaningful consequence, you're never going to fix the problem. They did an interesting study that looked at charter schools, and some charter schools are very effective. Some charter schools are very ineffective. And one of the things that they found about all of the effective charter schools was that they had very high disciplinary standards for students, and that translated into high test scores, better retention of teachers, and everything else. Now, I don't think that they probably suspended very many students, but they had something, and those are the kinds of things that we need to look at. The third thing I wanted to say, one of your guests was saying earlier that we need to use data and research more, and then was talking about how we need to have smaller class sizes. And with all due respect, and I know that this is unpopular, so maybe I'm just being a contrarian here, but the research actually suggests the opposite, that class sizes being smaller is not a very effective way of improving student outcomes, and it's a very, very expensive way. So anyway, those are just some
of
my
thoughts. What research says that?
Most of the people who are doing the serious research in education these days are people generally from an economics background. And most of I remember the Tennessee Star study was one of the keys, and what they found was, and this is a long time ago, and I'd have to look it up when I get home. But my recollection is that they were only able to see a difference when they were able to make the class sizes so small that in order to get them that small, you'd effectively have to double your labor budget.
So you can go, David, then we can go over here to Karen.
The reality is, particularly when you look at things like smaller class size, we know that if you are working in a classroom and you have students who are one or two grades behind, the more students you have in that room, that reduces the amount of one-on-one help and other kind of supports that you can provide. I mean, there are endless studies, both academic-based and academic-based research that you can find that can kind of substantiate any point that you're trying to make. I mean, for most classroom teachers, they would welcome having smaller classrooms so that they could be able to provide the students who are one or two academic grades behind more support, more encouragement. And so it's not necessarily rocket science. And even when you look at some of the very high performing schools, they tend to have smaller classrooms than some of the other schools that are not necessarily doing as well academically.
I don't think that smaller classes are necessarily the silver bullet. It's sort of the easy answer.
No, I'm not saying it's the silver bullet.
You're not going to let me talk?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Sorry, we just have to joust a little bit. I don't think that it's necessarily the silver bullet. I think it's the easy answer. I think that the expectations... That's the bottom line. And I'm speaking not from a person from North Avenue. I'm speaking from someone who turned a school around. And I've done it with small classes, and I've done it with large classes. But the one thing that remained constant was that we had expectations of the students, and we weren't just doing lip service. The entire school had the same set of expectations. It's incumbent upon the principal to articulate those expectations and to be vigilant about them. They have to be held for the principal and everyone else in the building. And if that doesn't happen, if there's a chink in the armor, so to speak, then the school will not be able to sustain a climate that will produce achievement. So it really, to me, is about school climate, creating school climate. And just one more thing about relationships. There are all different types of relationships. The relationship that you have as a teacher to 30 students is still a relationship. I may not know his middle name. I don't know, when he was born. But it's about respect, and it's about having students help teach one another. And I don't mean using, let me get the smart kid to be the teacher in the class, but learning about each other's experiences and using student voice in the classroom promotes some of the best climate I've ever seen.
Can I very quickly respond? First of all, I think that smaller classes is actually a pretty hard answer. It's not just an easy answer. But I want to say that in response to what the caller said, there's a recent study that came out that every dollar invested into good research-based things for students brings back $1.50 to $3 in revenue to the economy over the course of that child's $1 brings back $3 over the course of that child's life. So investing in our kids makes economic sense in addition to, obviously, the moral implications.
We have kind of stirred our listeners up here. Let's get on the caller now. We can throw out a question and come back to where we started this. And Drake, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Drake.
Hi. I do believe that, I disagree with one of your panelists. Maybe smaller classes aren't the silver bullet, but it sure is the gunpowder behind the bullet. And I also would like to say, or put this to your panel as well, is what do you think about hiring teachers not that have an education background, but actually comes from a mathematics background, teaching mathematics, a person teaching English, a sociologist teaching the social studies courses, and not grouped into education? Because I had, when I lived in Baltimore, I had teachers in my community, and they didn't even possess the English language. They spoke horribly. I'm like, and you're teaching school? Oh my God! I no wonder it's chaotic. But I came from. I was a product of Howard County Public Schools and Baltimore City Public Schools, and I came from Ann O. Emery. Dr. Emery was the principal of the school that I went to, and she also did have control of the professors that she hired, and she hired a lot of people with, I believe at that time, PhDs from Clark, my alma mater, and that's how I ended up going there. But she had control over the people she hired. But I think most of those people came from a background, not an educational background where they have everything, but they came from a concentrated background of mathematics, English, social studies, shop, what have you, and not just education where you have someone that's prominent in English trying to teach mathematics. I don't think that it works well. Thank you.
There's been a lot of talk about that. We've talked for years about what education training really means. Teaching teachers in teaching universities as opposed to getting people who know their area and then teaching them how to teach that area.
I think it's very important, especially in secondary school, because you have to be content rich. And then I must admit that I have sort of a bias because I'm a career changer myself. I'm a lawyer by training who came into the classroom. And I think that by so doing, I came in with a different skill set. I hadn't been taught how to think like an educator, and that was to my advantage.
So what does all the stuff we've just talked about in the last 35, 40 minutes here have to do with suspensions and discipline and keeping our school straight? How do we feed back to that from what we've just been saying?
I think it's multi-level because you're talking about quality teachers. You're talking about classroom size as one aspect of how to have environments that are conducive to learning. We're talking about school climate. The issues, when you talk suspensions, you're really talking about discipline. And when you talk about discipline, it's inextricably tied to teaching and learning and everything that has to do with the school.
I think at the end of the day, all students come to school wanting to learn. I mean, and that's every single student. And if you are able to meet their needs, they will learn. And they will not want to act out, and they will not want to engage in behaviors that may lead to them getting suspended at the end of the day.
I feel like the one thing that you brought up briefly, but we haven't touched on a lot, is the school-to-prison pipeline of criminalizing students in the school setting. And that's something that suspensions definitely does. It gives them a record. One thing we haven't mentioned is involving students in discipline, making street soldiers out of students, making student mentors, bringing students in to help the climate, I think is having student courts and stuff like that is really valuable.
And I'm going to go back to something I mentioned earlier. We didn't have a chance to talk a lot about it, but I just really struggle with our lack of engagement when it comes to parents. I mean, I really struggle because we keep talking about all of these systems, but we're not talking about that system where that child comes from. And my experience in working in Baltimore schools and Newark and many others, it just seems like the parent piece is always just an add-on. It isn't a real major focus, even the way that schools sort of roll out whether it's the parent night or whatever they do. Mm-hmm. And I just think that, like you said, students want to learn. Parents want their children to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
but we got to help parents sort of, to some degree, navigate the multiple threats mm-hmm. that they deal with on a regular basis. And that's not the role of necessarily a classroom teacher. But it is a law. It is a body of work that the larger school has to deal with. Looking at this issue of absent fathers, I mean, we almost never talk about, you know, this issue of, again, you have so many children in the building. A lot of times you got the PTA meetings. I was listening to the young man talk, and, you know, you mentioned moms, mm-hmm. right? It's almost as if we don't want fathers to be in the building. There doesn't really even seem to be sort of a concerted effort to even engage fathers. And so we talk a lot about systems. We could talk about a lot about technology in the classroom and teacher recruitment, all that kind of stuff. But if we're working with the larger communities and really working with the parents, then we see we see greater efforts working with the parents. We see I think that we'll see better outcomes related to students if we're able to get parents more involved on a number of levels.
And just a common sense way of dealing with parents is when their student is acting up, you bring mm-hmm. the student in the room and say, call your parent. Mm-hmm. Get your parent on the phone. Why are schools taking the full responsibility for all discipline? It makes no sense. Parents and schools can be on the same page. Mm-hmm. Parents have to be called in.
Let's get another caller on here, their thoughts, 410-319-8888. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thank you, and everyone for what's been a very interesting conversation.
Thanks for calling.
I guess from my perspective, when I think about this issue of suspensions and turning the tide against suspensions and looking at alternatives, it seems to me that the conversation really is about all the different ingredients that go into making a great school. And I heard Karen talk about relationships and creative play. And part of what I don't think is happening as much as it should be is the social-emotional development of our young people, starting at pre-K and K in first grade all the way through to high school, and really giving children the opportunity to self-manage at a very mm-hmm. young age through play and other types of interactions, so that by the time they are getting into middle and high school and interacting with their peers, they've learned alternatives to being upset or being frustrated or things that are happening as they interact with their peers, because they've learned how to manage themselves and to how to negotiate with each other through play, through interacting around project-based learning. I just went to a progressive education summit this past Saturday, hosted by City Neighbors.
Oh, yeah, right,
right. It was a
really
profound, wonderful conversation around what are we doing in our classrooms and how are we engaging with young people in a meaningful way. And I just want to add one last layer, that the resources issue is huge. The city has flat-funded city schools for a decade. The state has flat-funded city schools since 2007, and part of the issue is without the resources for the alternatives, for the smaller class sizes, to bring in some additional creative opportunities for young people so that they feel engaged in their learning, I think we are going to continue to struggle. So it is resources, but it is also what we do when we're in the classroom every day, and right now with the existing resources, we could be doing a better job, but we also, our kids deserve everything that that they need to be successful. Mm-hmm.
Sue, I appreciate the call, and I was thinking, as you were speaking, I was thinking, Ajaz, what Sue was saying, and that, you know, we have a school system geared towards tests and not towards the role of play and more mm-hmm. freedom, especially for younger kids to kind of learn. And the role that arts play, like in the school you're in, and it's critical, but it's so hard to implement that when we're focused on standardized testing.
Definitely, and I think that it's really hard for a school to justify giving a lot of resources to, let's say, an arts program like in my school, when at the end of the day they're being measured on their mm-hmm. progress on standardized testing. And so that's a conflict within schools, is how can you justify giving resources to an area that we know can benefit children, but at the end of the day, we're not being measured with a metric that measures mm-hmm. that kind of growth and development.
Again, I go back to what I say all the time when I talk about our public schools, which is that our public school students in Baltimore City and everywhere else deserve the same kind of education kids get in private and parochial schools. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think about this all the time, mm-hmm. that this is something that we need to learn from and start saying, these systems work, and yeah. why do they work?
I think all students in the country should have the same per pupil funding as the students in Montgomery County, because they seem to be doing pretty well. So I think we need to prioritize whatever that number is that Montgomery County uses. Every single child in the country should get that for their neighborhood school. Then see how broken education is.
I think education is not the priority it should be, and that's part of the problem. And I think that it's interesting how this conversation was supposed to be about suspensions, but we went all over the place back to it. And I think that's because that when you talk about suspension policy, you're actually really talking about the internal workings of a school and how those schools function, how they should function. And I think that it's sometimes we said that, and it's important to kind of get into the depth of that rather than.
And I also think, Mark, one of the critical questions that we have to ask ourselves is, do we want to be able to compete globally? I mean, do we really, are we serious about being able to compete? I mean, I think that we have to be able to answer that question.
And what does that mean?
Yeah, and what does that really mean? What does it look like? And what are some of the opportunities that are afforded children if they receive an education which will allow them to compete on a global stage?
I agree. Can we sneak one more caller in very quick? Cynthia, very quick thought.
I wanted to say that I agreed with a couple of the previous callers in terms of the disciplinary practices that the school has, but I don't think that they've taken the opportunity to look at the root causes of those kids who act out in school. In my observations, I believe that a lot of that is caused by the ongoing conflict within the home. So when we leave the parents out of the equation, all you're going to continue to have is kids acting out in school. I think one of the things that we don't do in the earlier grades is that we go to young people's homes and ask their parents, mom in particular, can I bring your kid to my school and teach your kid for X number of hours a day a different culture that is being taught within the home? So you have this loyalty between the kids and their families, which is in conflict with the culture in the school. So therefore, you're always going to have this conflict. So I think there should be greater conversation about involving parents, but not in a judgmental way, but one asking parents permission. Can I teach your kid and raise your kid in a different culture and environment that they're used to in their home, which is not to put that down.
All right, Cynthia, I'm sorry. That's a great way to end this, and I think it was great to start a new conversation. I want to thank you for your call. I want to thank all of our four guests for their dedication to our young people and to making this world a better place for our children and really working hard at it with their daily lives all day. David Miller, Ajaz Baluk, Iris Kirsch, Karen Weber, Nandor, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
I do mean that.
Thank you.
You all really are dedicated to our kids, and that's what we need more of. So thank you also for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break, and we're going to switch gears. It is Super Bowl time. We have on our program a guest coming in from San Francisco to talk at it with our Ravens guests. So don't go away.